This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. The San Diego Housing Federation's annual Ruby Awards is the county's largest affordable housing community recognition event. They'll honor the best people, projects, and achievements from the past year. Join the awards on June 6th at the Marriott Marquis San Diego Marina. Early bird pricing is available until April 12th. Secure your tickets today at housingsandiego.org. That's housingsandiego.org.
Yeah, the joke is, right, the kidnappers kidnapped a cardiologist and an immunologist, and they said, okay, whichever one of you is most important to the world, we'll set free. And so the cardiologist says, well, you know, heart disease and heart drugs and heart surgeries do all kinds of great stuff. And they go, yeah, okay, that's pretty good. And I say, immunologist, what have you succeeded at? You know, and the immunologist says, well, it's complicated, see, because the immune system is that. And the cardiologist says, shoot me now.
Thanks for joining us on this Voice of San Diego podcast bonus episode. I'm Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice of San Diego. I've taken an active interest in vaccines and how they work. Now, that might be because they hold the promise of giving our society the confidence it needs to bring life back, to bring school back, parties, sports, culture. We want to bring it back, and we want to bring it back better. But I started to get frustrated about what I did not understand about how vaccines worked. What is the difference between the prominent vaccines meant to protect people from COVID-19? What about pregnant women? What about children? I knew you had a lot of questions as well. Today, we're talking to Shane Crotty. He leads the Crotty Lab at the La Jolla Institute for Immunology at UC San Diego.
I'm obsessed with vaccines and vaccine immunology, and that's basically always been the case for my lab. So yeah, we've been busy this past year.
His team did groundbreaking research on how the human body reacts when it first sees SARS-2, as he calls it. I wanted to start with the basics. How is it that after so many years of technological advancements, the fight against a disease like this still relies on our body's own defenses, molded after millions of years of evolution? It blows my mind that our most effective weapon against this virus that we're all obsessed about and dealing with is our own body, our own immune system. It just still blows my mind that it can adapt, that it can be so precise, and that it needs to be so precise for all these new threats that come. So help me understand 101, what happens when a virus enters the body? What does your immune system do? What does that actually look like?
It is amazing what the immune system can pull off. And the problem your body faces is that viruses can divide every few hours, right? So the generation time of a virus is a few hours and they mutate, whereas the generation time for a person is like 20 years. So you're at like a 10,000-fold evolutionary disadvantage to a virus in terms of speed of change. So how can you possibly protect yourself, right, against viruses that don't even exist yet, right, on an evolutionary timescale? And so the immune system has multiple strategies for dealing with that, but the one that we're really talking about here that's relevant for vaccines is the adaptive immune system. And the brilliant solution there is your immune system has billions of cells that can each recognize a different molecular structure. And so essentially you have cells in your immune system that can recognize any possible molecular structure in the universe, which is pretty amazing. So like people have actually made novel chemicals that have never existed before and shown that, you know, your immune system can learn to recognize those. And so to some extent, then it doesn't matter if the virus exists now or in the future, right? Your immune system has some cells that can recognize that new or old virus. While that's a brilliant solution, the downside to it is there's essentially only a handful of cells in your body that can recognize any given new virus. And so the problem you face is when you get infected with a new virus, somewhere in your body are cells of your immune system that can recognize and kill off that virus, but there are only a few of them. And so now it's a race between the virus that's dividing, right, in your nose, your lungs, and it might kill you, and your immune system that's trying to grow fast enough, go from just a few cells to many, many cells that can, until there are enough cells that can kill off the virus. So that's the normal way your immune system fights things, and it in a more complicated way. Some of that's antibodies, and then some of that's also T cells. They're both sets of things. And so the whole basis of vaccines is to say, okay, that's how your immune system works. It's normally a race. Well, let's get rid of the race. Let's go ahead and show your immune system in advance. Okay, here's what this virus looks like, right? Here's its mugshot. Learn what this looks like and go ahead, instead of having those handful of cells, go ahead and grow and respond and make that immune response. So you've already got the antibodies and the T cells in advance. You've already learned what the virus looks like before you're infected, sort of on your own time. So that when the virus shows up and you actually get infected, there's no longer a race. You've already got all the weapons of the immune system ready for you. And so the big challenge for vaccines is to figure out how to do the teaching.
Is that the only model for vaccines right now, is to teach your body to react like that? Is it so successful and just time and again proven that there's really no other way to protect the body from something like this other than to train its natural defenses?
Mostly, the answer is yes. You can short-term get protection by saying, well, okay, one of the main ways your immune system works is to make antibodies. So what if we just manufacture those antibodies and then you can inject those antibodies and they'll circulate and be protective. And so that those work for a period of weeks or a couple of months, and then those the injected antibodies all fade away. So you can do short-term solutions, and in fact, they're being really successful right now. They started doing in high-risk settings, right? So the big one that's been done so far is nursing homes, and so let's just do a study where we inject everybody with antibodies that we know are protective, and sure enough, they've been able to knock down cases by a large amount. But essentially, the idea is a vaccine can do the same thing sort of forever, right? So if you it's a give a person a fish versus teach them how to fish kind of situation, right?
Yeah. So, but let me ask you. So there, you mentioned the antibodies and you mentioned the T cells, and there's two types of T cells. The antibodies, are you saying those are more like just kind of general fighters? They're ready to fight anything that comes in. They don't need to be taught different things, or they all need to be taught? It's just that sometimes the antibodies that have been taught from other people can be transferred over to new people.
The latter. So whether it's antibodies or T cells, they have to be taught. And what's special about antibodies is that they are proteins, and so you can manufacture proteins and you can manufacture antibodies, and that's been something that pharma and biotech have worked on for 20, 30 years at this point. And so it's doable to make, you can actually clone out an antibody from a person and say, oh yeah, that's a really good one for fighting this virus. And so then you can manufacture lots of that. And that does work. Antibodies generally work best in advance of an infection. And so if to oversimplify the immune system, antibodies are really good at preventing an infection, stopping a virus at the front door. But once you get infected, now the virus is inside your cells, and antibodies generally can't recognize viruses inside a cell. And so that's where the T cells come in handy. The T cells are good at scanning through your body and figuring out which cells have virus hidden inside them and killing off those cells. And so they're simply complementary tools. Antibodies stop virus outside of cells. T cells stop viruses inside of cells.
So in immunology, in the history of vaccines, it has mostly been about figuring out what the virus or the contagion is, and then somehow trying to introduce it to the body so that you can have this teach to fish moment for your antibodies and T cells. But something special happened this time, which is that we figured out how to make that education possible for our T cells and antibodies without actually introducing a version of the virus, but really something new, this RNA. Can you describe what is happening with that on a real low level for us?
Yeah, so there are several advantages to RNA vaccine technology. The basic concept for how it works is cells in your body are, well, they're alive. And so part of being alive is having metabolism. And so they constantly make lots of proteins and lots of RNA. So any given cell in your body probably has like 5,000 RNAs in it right now. And each RNA you can think of as a post-it note that's got some message written on it. And that's an instruction for the cell. So they're like 5,000 messages flying around inside the cell at any given time. And they're all temporary messages. They basically, like a post-it note, they get shredded up and thrown away, and then it's time for the next to-do list item, right? And so RNA vaccines try to take advantage of that normal process of a cell and say, well, okay, how about we introduce a new RNA into the cell, a new post-it note to the cell, and tell the cell to make one piece of the virus. And so in this case, it's like the spike protein of coronavirus. So not the whole virus, but one piece. And that has a couple of advantages. One is that you don't have to know how to grow the virus. Some viruses are really hard to grow. And so all you have to know is the genetic sequence of the virus to build from that. And the other is it's pretty cheap and simple manufacturing wise to synthesize an RNA, that these RNA messages. And so you can do that. You inject somebody with that. Now that you've just got this message, it's essentially a post-it note. The cells will read that. They'll make the spike protein. And that now is the teachable moment to the immune system to see, oh, wait, there's this spike protein that's normally not around. We should recognize that. And one of the nice safety features of that is coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, has about 25 different proteins, and spike's just one of them. So it takes 25 different proteins to actually make a virus. So you just show one of those to the immune system. So there's no way that it can make a virus, but it's showing an important part of the virus to the immune system.
So I got the Moderna first dose last week. And so over the last few days, what you're saying is that my cells, not just in my arm, but now throughout my body, are creating that one small part of the coronavirus to kind of teach the whole system to be ready for it, because that is such an important part of the coronavirus?
So yes, with just the edit that it was probably expressing that spike protein for a couple of days. That's about how long the RNA is around and expresses for, is probably like 2 days. And that almost all of that expression is going to be local, really close to where it was injected. Your immune system is localized in lymph nodes, okay, that are scattered throughout your body. And so in this particular case, almost all of that immune response is going to happen your armpit lymph nodes.
Wow.
So the material will basically drain through special conduits to those lymph nodes and respond there. And then the entirety of your immune system is connected by your circulatory system, your blood. And so once those cells of the immune system learn about this new virus in that local lymph node, they'll circulate throughout your entire body, including, for example, through your nasal passages and whatnot, and just constantly be on the lookout for that virus. So you get immunized in your arm, but the cells of your immune system will look everywhere in your body for if they see any more of that spike anywhere, which would be a new virus showing up.
Now, I've heard a lot of folks who got the second dose of some of these, Moderna and others, who are, you know, experiencing some really significant fevers, chills, stuff like that afterward. So what is happening with that? Their immune system thinks it's being attacked, and it needs to sort of kick off all of the standard body functions that help it fight that race that you talk about?
Yeah, that's exactly it, Scott. The way to think about it is Your immune system's actually really good at ignoring things. You're constantly getting exposed to stuff that's not actually a threat to you, right? Dirt or food or, you know, a scratch from some plant. Your immune system does a risk-benefit analysis, essentially, of any new thing that it sees to, first of all, just respond or not, but then even when it responds, how much to respond, and then also how much to remember, okay? So when you make an immune response, sometimes that immune response will just go away pretty quickly and you don't actually have any immune memory. And other times with a really good vaccine, like the yellow fever vaccine or the smallpox vaccine, you get one immunization and your body remembers that for the rest of your life. Like we've gone and taken blood from people, you know, 70 years after they got the smallpox vaccine, and there's still immune memory in those people. And that's where your body's doing a risk-benefit analysis about how much energy, how many resources should be committed to fight this threat and then remember this threat. And so the challenge and really brilliance of vaccines is to get your body to respond to something that isn't a threat, right? That spike protein itself, in and of itself, isn't a threat. But you're trying to convince the body it is enough of a threat. There's a difference between vaccines being safe and vaccines giving you a low-grade fever or making you feel lousy for a day. It's still completely safe. It's a sign that your immune system's actually responding, actually probably properly, right, to this vaccine that you've been given.
And if you don't feel those things, does that mean that your body hasn't responded?
So that's a really good question. And it's interesting because for the RNA vaccines, there's definitely a clear correlation with age there. That for example, people over the age of 65 more often don't have these effects of the second dose as opposed to younger individuals. And yet the immune responses between those two groups are pretty equivalent for those RNA vaccines.
Is the second dose of these RNA vaccines a different product? Is it a different
same thing? No, it's exact same thing.
So why would the second is your body like, wow, there's really something coming after us, we got to take it seriously this time, that's what's happening?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So same thing, your body doing a risk benefit analysis. You know, if it sees something once, okay, it's some kind of threat. If it sees it again, that's more worrisome. And so vaccines take advantage of that. It's fairly common for vaccines to be a three immunization series, which again falls on that same idea. And I wouldn't be surprised actually if some of the RNA vaccines become essentially kind of a lower dose in the future and spread out over three, you know, to see how that affects. In the current pandemic, obviously the goal was get the vaccine as quickly as possible. And so Pfizer went with, well, we think the fastest we could possibly do it would be day one and day 21. And Moderna said, well, we think it's day one and day 28. And it's possible that if you had the luxury of spreading it out, you know, over 6 months, you could do it a bit differently.
I'm curious about this language that we use that is very anthropomorphic. Like we're pretending that these immune systems are little men with plans and or women, and they're thinking about it, and they're, you know, they've got these control panels, and they're like, well, this is a real threat, this is not a real threat. But what's really happening, and it's just I cannot comprehend it, but it is a series of chemical reactions that are causing this, right? It's a series of physical exchanges or something. It's not that there's a brain thinking about this, or is it? I don't quite understand how it's so strategic.
Yeah, it's at the bottom level, it's a series of biochemical interactions that have been tens of millions of years, you know, of evolution in the process, and there's been really strong selective pressure, right, for successful immune systems. At the simplest level, again, your immune system is made, let's say, a billion different cells that can each express a different antibody. Okay, so you can make literally a billion, it's actually billions of different individual antibodies, and those cells just sit there, and they basically have the antibodies on their surface, and most of the time, they're never going to see anything in their whole life. But every once in a while, one of them, that the antibody on the surface of the cell binds to something, and that triggers a chemical reaction that says, oh, there's something that I'm physically binding to, and since I'm physically binding to that, that's a bad thing. That's some foreign object. Maybe it's a virus. So that triggers a response by that cell. And then there are other cells of the immune system that have to agree basically with that decision. They have to also see some piece of the virus, and then those cells have to come together and say, yep, I saw piece A, you saw piece B. We're pretty convinced that there's a viral infection now. And then there are other cells in the body that are programmed to just sense the presence of virus or viral genetic material or sense damage of cells, and all of those things piecing together are the various bits of information that the immune system is integrating to say, yes, this is a viral infection. Here's what it looks like, and here's how concerned you should be about it.
We have talked about the RNA vaccines, the Moderna, the Pfizer. There are others now, and we're starting to administer locally the Johnson & Johnson, Janssen Pharmaceuticals. That is not an RNA one. That is an actual viral vector. They've taken part of the virus and injected. They're injecting that into you. Now, one of the things I think is a little bit worrisome is how that vaccine has been sort of considered in some cases like a lower effective effort, or that it's not as valuable, or that if some groups of people get it, that might be a sign of discrimination or something. You should wait for the better one. Can you help us understand the efficacy? So they said that Johnson & Johnson was 66% effective and that the Pfizer was 95% effective, but that does not mean that 5% of people got it or that 34% of people got it in the Johnson & Johnson tests. It's something different. What are they actually saying with effectiveness there?
Good questions. So yes, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is different technology, and it's an adenoviral vector technology, and there are several COVID vaccines that are using related technology. And in fact, it's been a technology that's been around for about 20 years, and there's a licensed Ebola vaccine that uses that technology. So it's something that we know some about. So the Pfizer vaccine had 95% efficacy, the Moderna vaccine had 95% efficacy, and the Johnson & Johnson one-dose vaccine had 72% efficacy, is the number that I prefer there. And those, the efficacy number ends up coming from, in the actual vaccine trial, essentially, right? Half the people got the vaccine and half the people got placebo. And then you count up all the cases in the placebo group and you count up all the cases in the vaccinated group, and that gives you your percent efficacy. So if there are 100 cases of COVID in the placebo group and there are 5 cases in the vaccine group, that's a 95% efficacy. There are a couple of additional factors to that. One is that the case definition is made differently in the different vaccine trials. So essentially for Pfizer and Moderna, it was any symptoms, and for Johnson & Johnson, it was slightly more severe symptoms. I think the take-home message that a lot of people have tried to communicate is that that's the efficacy against any symptomatic disease at all. And what's most worrisome, of course, is COVID-19 that results in hospitalization or death. And all three of those vaccines had essentially equivalent protective immunity and essentially complete protective immunity against hospitalizations or deaths. And so that's why public health officials are using the language of they're all essentially equivalent, take the first one you get offered, because they're going to stop the most important thing, which is the hospitalization and deaths. One wrinkle to the clinical trials. So one thing is people say, well, you can't compare those numbers exactly head-to-head because the vaccines weren't compared head-to-head. And one reason for saying something like that is, for example, the Moderna and Pfizer clinical trials were during the summer when there wasn't that much virus going around, in the fall. And then the Johnson & Johnson vaccine was being tested in the nasty surge, right, in the Thanksgiving time window, when it really might have been significantly harder to protect people because there was so much virus around. So those numbers may not be directly comparable. But I, for one, I think those numbers are reasonable. To me, the other layer to this is that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is testing a two-dose regimen, right? So they said, well, one dose is a lot more convenient and easier to roll out. And frankly, a lot of people just want to take one dose of a vaccine. They would prefer a one dose to a two dose for convenience, even if it's not quite as perfectly effective. And so J&J took that approach, but they are also testing a two dose and right, the Pfizer and Moderna are both two dose vaccines, and the data on a two dose J&J should be available within the next month. And if those results look even better, right, then you get into some interesting decisions, because if that vaccine is significantly better, it probably is then significantly better at preventing transmission, you know, and preventing just any symptomatic case. And so I wouldn't be surprised if then a two-dose Johnson & Johnson vaccine got licensed in the U.S. and that anybody who had gotten one dose would then get a follow-up dose kind of thing. You know, what happens then outside the U.S. gets a lot more complicated.
Yeah. Well, so when you're talking about the hospitalization thing, so when you described earlier that, you know, when a virus comes into your body, it kicks off this race where your immune system tries to ramp up its fight, and then the virus tries to spread and divide itself as fast as possible across your body. And whoever, you know, if you lose that battle, that's where death and hospitalizations occur, right? So what you're saying is that even if it's less effective, it still makes that race something your body can win, right? Is that kind of what we're getting at?
Yeah, and if you want to get a little more disease specific, it looks like the most likely explanation for thinking about this disease is that it's an infection that's fought on two battlegrounds, essentially. There's the initial infection of your nose and your upper respiratory tract, and then there's the infection of your lungs, right? And so it's the severe pneumonia in your lungs that is fatal. And for this disease, SARS-2 replicates very, very quickly in your nasal passages, right? And so it's already gotten to a point where it can be transmissible in like 4 days after infection, right? Before you have any symptoms. And that's been one of the big challenges with this virus, right? That there's probably about half of transmission occurs before people are symptomatic. That's because the virus replicates so fast in the nasal passages, and it's pretty good at evading the immune system, that by the time your immune system even notices that it's there, there's already so much virus in your nasal passages that it's ready to spread to other people. But in contrast, the viral replication and spread in the lungs is quite slow. And in fact, the average time to death, right, is like 25 days. That's a very long time, particularly given that your immune system responds in an exponential way, right? Things dividing even a day is a fairly long period of time. So it's relatively hard to stop the virus from infecting you at all and having getting to a point of transmitting or having any symptoms, but it's a lot easier to keep the virus from growing much in your lungs and causing any pneumonia, which is significantly before even hospitalization would occur. And so that's the distinction.
Okay, that might help us with this question that came in from a listener who said, what about transmission after you get the vaccine? If I'm to sort of deduce from what you've just said, then we might be protected if we're vaccinated from that severe experience, but there could be infections that our immune system hasn't reacted to in our nose or whatever that could still spread the virus is what I deduce from what you just said.
So, and that's why public health officials have been pretty hesitant to say things about changing your personal behavior when you've been vaccinated and how well the vaccines prevent transmission. There's essentially more data almost every week on that's relevant to transmission. Directly proving block of transmission's complicated, takes a lot of data. But if a surrogate is asymptomatic infections, okay? If you can't find any virus in somebody's saliva or nose, who didn't have any symptoms, they either weren't infected at all or they had a really, really low infection. And so it's highly unlikely that such a person is going to pass on any virus to other people. And so that's now been measured in a series of independent studies. The first data actually came from the Moderna clinical trial. And now there's a large-scale study by the Mayo Clinic in the US and a large-scale study of nurses in the UK. And large-scale study across like the entire Israeli population, and actually data from the J&J clinical trial too. And all of those together are indicating that the RNA vaccines are probably, once you're fully vaccinated, the RNA vaccines are probably like 80 to 95% effective at preventing transmission, which is really good. That's a very good number. And the J&J vaccine looks like it's probably in actually the 70% range for preventing transmission, which is also good. The big concern was, the big worry was that, oh, maybe these vaccines keep people from getting sick, but they're still just going to spread virus all over the place, and that would be a big problem. That is not happening. An exact number isn't in hand. Well, actually, I think some of the public health recommendations are already changing because of these pieces of data.
Fascinating. So the direct answer is we don't know exactly how well it transmits among people who are vaccinated, but the initial numbers indicate that it's pretty good at suppressing it.
Yeah, and essentially, probably pretty close to as good at suppressing transmission as it is at suppressing cases.
One of the things I learned from some other scientists, colleagues at UC San Diego have done a lot of work and helped me understand that somebody who's exposed to a lot of the virus can get a worst case of it, that sort of gives the virus a chance to really start that race with a lot more troops and get going. And so would that be part of what explains why the vaccine allows even some cases to happen, is that sometimes you're exposed to so many viruses that your body can do its best, but it's still going to be overwhelmed by the number of troops coming in from the enemy?
Yeah, absolutely. And in humans, that's a tough thing to prove, but it's pretty straightforward in animal models where you can take, okay, we're going to give an animal X amount, or we're going to give them 10 times as much, or 100 times as much, or 1,000 times as much. And the severity of disease tracks with the amount of virus exposed. Overall, that's the case. And when people go and do all these swabs, right, you can see the published data on this. In swabs, there's a million-fold range in how much virus people are detecting, right, in one person versus another. Wow. In terms of how much is in the swab. So when people talk about super spreaders, that's the type of thing, you know, you're trying to think about, is are there some people who are really just breathing out massively more virus than an average person? And so how well do you get protected against that? And so yes, that definitely comes into play into the vaccine efficacy, is some of the breakthroughs are going to be related to, well, yeah, you still got sick, but wow, you would have really gotten sick if you didn't get the vaccine, because the vaccine really blunted that input. And honestly, that's one of the classic arguments for masks as well, is that even if the mask doesn't totally keep you from getting infected, it almost certainly reduced the amount of virus that got into your nose. And so you're in better shape than if you hadn't been wearing that mask.
We're going to take a quick break. On the other side, how long we'll have to keep getting COVID shots. Stay with us.
The San Diego Housing Federation's annual Ruby Awards is the county's largest affordable housing community recognition event. They'll honor the best people, projects, and achievements from the past year. Join the awards on June 6th at the Marriott Marquis San Diego Marina. Early bird pricing is available until April 12th. Secure your tickets today at housingsandiego.org. That's housingsandiego.org. This podcast is sponsored in part by Intesa Communications Group, a women-owned PR and government relations firm that helps you communicate and advocate with confidence. Intesa colleagues are deeply ingrained in the issues and communities you care about most. From universities and nonprofits to corporate developers, theme parks, and tech titans, Intesa helps thoughtful leaders from all sectors shape San Diego for the better. Learn more at intesacom.com.
One of the questions that came up was whether people will need to keep getting shots over time, maybe next year, yearly. Is this is this what we're thinking? Do we have any idea how long it lasts? You mentioned smallpox prepares the body's immune system for decades. Do we have any idea what this one does to our immune system and how long it lasts?
So there are two quite different components to that answer. The quick answer is it's likely that a booster vaccine is going to be desirable by the fall. After that, yeah, there's definitely a likelihood that there will be a round of booster immunizations in the fall. And so that's for two different reasons. Even for the RNA vaccines, even as the first data were becoming available from the clinical trials that they were so fantastic, right, giving 95% protection, it was immediately being said, but you might have to have annual booster immunizations. And that's because it's very hard to predict immune memory. And really the best way to predict immune memory is to look at other examples. But there aren't other examples of RNA vaccines. So we can't look and say, oh, these other RNA vaccines have lasted for 1, 2, or 5 years. And in fact, the little bit of data that's available has indicated that that they fade within a year, that memory doesn't last past a year. And so for RNA vaccines, it may just be that they're fantastic, but you got to get an immunization every year. Now, again, what we talked about earlier, once your immune system sees things a couple of times, right, it maybe starts remembering better. So it's possible the first one, you got to get it a year, but then after that, maybe go longer. Different vaccine technologies are different. So some groups are betting that the viral vectors, like the J&J vaccine, actually generate better immune memory. So the protective efficacy might not be quite as high initially, but it might last longer, which obviously would have some potential benefits. The other side of the whole topic is the virus and the variants. And so the South Africa variant is different enough, good enough at avoiding at least some of your body's antibody responses, that it warrants a booster vaccine specifically targeting the South Africa variant. And Moderna has already started a booster vaccine clinical trial as of last week. Like, they managed to make that new vaccine in like 3 weeks and then get it into people like 2 weeks after that.
Wow.
Just incredibly fast. And they'll know 6 weeks from now if that booster vaccine is doing what they hope. So those are the two sides of that answer.
You mentioned that the virus has a much smaller evolutionary timescale. So what you're saying there is it can mutate and then it can go through an evolutionary selection system, natural selection. It dies or survives so much faster than like us. If we grew an extra ear, like it would take hundreds, millions of years for us to decide if that was really a more fit situation for our bodies. But for viruses, they mutate immediately and then they either succeed or they don't really fast. And so I was under the impression that when a virus evolved, it usually got less lethal, like it spread easier because it wasn't killing its host so well. But it seems like these are all being characterized with significant alarm. Are they better at it?
And so that theory you mentioned is a popular theory for people to say, well, as viruses evolve, they become more attuned to their host and they become less lethal. It's not true. It's a nice bedtime story. It's just not true. The virus is going to do whatever is best for the virus. All the virus cares about is spreading. And so what drives the virus is to spread as fast as possible. And so spreading fast as possible is really how fast can the virus grow in your upper respiratory tract, right? And just spread to other people. And so that should be essentially independent of lethality, because again, the lethality in severe disease comes to the pneumonia, which isn't really, that's not helping out this virus. That's essentially inconsequential. So I think there's basically not selection for or against lethality in this particular virus. But in this case, again, with this coronavirus and coronaviruses in general, really their spread is all about what's going on in your nasal passages. And so the UK variant just happens to do that even faster. And so it spreads better.
The viruses, you're saying, are built to spread, and they don't care about anything else. They don't care about what they do to you or what they don't do to you. Their entire makeup is about what is the best way that we can spread? And then the winners are the ones that spread better. And so what you're saying is if it gets in your head and can spread easily there, it doesn't matter if it gets farther down and kills the person. It's going to do its best to make that process more effective, and that the UK one and maybe the South African one do that part better. They stick and they also can fly better or whatever. There was a lot of questions about pregnant women, and I'm not sure exactly why this came up as a specific separate thing. I know that pregnancy can often boost the immune system. Do you know anything about why women who are carrying children need to worry about it more, or should get it more, or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you why it's coming up. It's coming up for the big reason it's coming up has been actually a misinformation anti-vaxxer campaign that it's just been a straight up misinformation campaign preying on people's fears, and it just got spread really quickly. So it's been tough to counter about basically just some completely bogus stuff. And so there's a person, Vicky Mail, who she put together a really good set of explanations on Twitter for what the actual data are. And so the RNA vaccine, the COVID RNA vaccines are very safe for pregnant women and breastfeeding women. It's interesting. Usually you don't have information like that for a new vaccine. But these vaccine trials were so large. They had so many people, 15,000 per trial that got vaccinated. We actually have a lot more safety data on these vaccines than we do for, frankly, almost any other medical intervention that's ever gone to the public before, because it was the way to get the information quickly was to do it in a huge number of people. And so because those trials were so large, pregnant women were excluded from the clinical trials as they basically always are from any initial phase 3 clinical trial. But inadvertent pregnancies happen. And there were so many people in these trials that there were actually a decent number of pregnancies and they occurred throughout the trial. And in each case, the pregnancies were fine and no different than the placebo group. And so the FDA made the specific recommendation that it's totally fine for pregnant women to get vaccinated, and definitely fine for breastfeeding women to get vaccinated. And then it's come up again now this past week, because now pregnant women have been, at least in California, pregnant women have been approved to get the vaccine. And so I know at least some healthcare providers are very actively reaching out to pregnant women and encouraging them to get vaccinated, which I think is why people who didn't know they were going to have vaccine questions yet, because they didn't think they were going to be eligible, and they're like, oh wait, now I'm eligible for the vaccine. Should I actually get it? And that's what the data are. There were pregnancies for the RNA vaccines. There were women who got pregnant in the clinical trials, and it was all fine. And literally, people are aware of it just because of social media misinformation campaigns by the main anti-vaxxer group in the world.
So there's a lot of questions about kids. I think a lot of people saying like it's this virus doesn't seem to really threaten kids near to the extent. I mean, what a blessing for this situation that's not the opposite. So a lot of questions about why can't kids get it now? What is the difference with their immune system? Is it just a precautionary? We want to test it more. And then, what's the outlook on one being available for them?
Yeah, great questions. So pediatric vaccine, it's just kids are a special population. And so it's just a medical rule of thumb, right? That you can't just take the medicine and start giving it to kids. You have to show that it's both safe and effective in kids. And so vaccines are no different. They have to be actively tested in the kids. And if you're lucky, you can just dose it down. If the adult dose is whatever, then the pediatric dose should be a quarter of that, and that's probably fine. Often that works. And one of the things with the additional thing with kids, at least for vaccines, is generally you can't just treat all kids as kids. You have to do it in several age groups, and you have to show it's okay in older kids before you can go to younger kids, before you can go to infants. And usually that's like a series of three clinical trials in a row. So it can take quite a while. So I've certainly been warning people, you know, it could be 2022 before vaccines are approved for first graders, just because of that normal process of having to work your way down through age groups in the vaccine trials. Certainly several of the vaccine companies are working as fast as they can to do those clinical trials, but they do still have to do them.
As an immunologist, do you feel it is imperative that we get the vaccine for kids, you know, knowing everything we know about the virus and how it affects them?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, as an immunologist, the disease burden in kids is low. So, you know, no, I'd say as an immunologist, it's not that imperative. But as a virologist, right, or as a public health person or an epidemiologist, it looks like the kids, there are tons of arguments going on about exactly how much kids spread, but I think it's a fair argument to say they can spread approximately as much as anybody else. You know, maybe it's like half as much or twice, but it's in that same range. They definitely are little human beings that do get infected and can spread. And so, yeah, if you want to shut down spread in the community, you want them to be vaccinated as well, particularly if you think the vaccines are good at preventing transmission, which, as I said, it looks like they are. So I definitely think it makes sense to get kids vaccinated as soon as possible. But it's much faster to vaccinate all the teachers. So yeah, I'm in agreement with the CDC recommendations that that schools can open safely, but that it should be a very high priority to get teachers vaccinated to make that as safe a situation as possible. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Is there anything else people should keep in mind about the various vaccines, about how your body works and how it protects us?
So I would say... vaccines only work if you take them. These vaccines really work.
Thanks for listening to this Voice of San Diego podcast bonus episode. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. Keep up with all of our public health news and takes on local stories with The Morning Report. That is our most popular product and newsletter. Get it at vosd.org/newsletters. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice of San Diego. This show is produced by Nate John. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon.